Hey, how's it going?
Yeah, not too bad. Just being very online lately, I guess. I don't know, like, starting the Substack and stuff, and just very immersed in the kind of 2025 moment, I guess.
I feel like I'm kind of the exact opposite of that right now. I have very little what's really going on online, but so you can help fill me in which is good. But yeah, so why have you specifically, your Substack is amazing. I've been reading it quite a bit. I love all your, I've been a fan of your writing for years now. So this is a great opportunity to speak with, I think, one of the smartest art, social, technology, theory writers and educators. So, you know.
Oh, thanks. I won't be able to live up to that, but yeah. I'll try.
So you started writing about, well, we can unpack a lot of stuff here. The Zizians, and some of your recent writing is kind of, you're kind of reflecting on the neurotic subjects of digital capitalism and, you know, people who are kind of alienated and disembodied, and they're seeking a kind of salvation in code and control and collapse. I think you have two different, you could say, postmodern in a Frederick Jameson sense subjects. You have the neo-reactionary movement on one hand, and then you have the Zizians, which is, for lack of a better word, I think it's more kind of like dark nihilistic centrism or leftism. I'm not exactly sure how to characterize it. It doesn't appear quite clear to me, but I kind of wanted to like unpack some of these essays that you've written and kind of try to figure out why this is bad and why you should be aware of it, and also why it shouldn't, you know, potentially consume us and, you know, get us into this cycle.
No, that sounds good. No, totally. Yeah. Have you done an episode on the Zizians or anything?
No. I know a lot of people have, but it's generally from a more historical or like parapolitical angle of trying to sort of piece together these facts and, you know, historical fragments. And I'm more interested in it as like a, like theoretically and as a, you know, phenomena.
Yeah, me too. Me too, definitely. Just very briefly, in case people don't know, because I've sort of heard about the Zizians very in passing for a couple of years now, just through very kind of niche kind of online Twitter circles and such. Yeah, they definitely came to a much more kind of spectacular attention, kind of more mainstream attention just this year, like actually on the day of the Trump's inauguration. I don't know, just to sort of introduce them, I guess. So on the day of Trump's inauguration, this sort of like border patrol agent in Vermont, I think, was doing a routine traffic stop, and he was shot and killed by these two assailants who are members of the Zizian cult. And then that's when the kind of law enforcement investigation sort of started to connect a lot of dots between those two assailants and then a bunch of different figures. So on New Year's Eve of, I think, 2022, this married couple was shot and killed in their home in Pennsylvania, and their daughter is alleged to have purchased guns that were found at the Border Patrol agent shooting. So that linked, that those murders were suddenly linked, a kind of cross-country kind of murder spree. This is the really crazy one, I think. A couple of days before, the Border Patrol agent shooting, this guy, Curtis Lind, in California, was killed by another Zizian who was engaged to one of the Border Patrol shooters. And what's particularly interesting about this Curtis Lind guy is it seems like the reason he was killed was because he was actually going to be a key witness in a trial against former tenants of one of his properties,
right,
who were charged with impaling him with a samurai sword, which he survived. But
yeah.
So that's kind of how suddenly all these kinds of murders were starting to be connected over the past couple of years, like across country in the US. And they were all believed to be members of, if you sort of follow their kind of digital footprint, they all seem to be connected by being members of, yeah, this so-called Zizian cult, this sort of San Francisco Bay Area cult. Yeah, so named after the apparent leader, Ziz, who's a really kind of interesting figure. That's kind of what most of the reportings are like. But yeah, I was more interested in, just because of my background in kind of like philosophy of AI, as you were saying and stuff, like I was kind of more interested in the kind of Zizian philosophy, because Ziz in particular, but all of these, a lot of these Zizians had kind of Tumblrs and, you know, blogs.
Their philosophical influences are very uncouth. They're extremely cringe, which, you know, kind of manifests in their deficit of aesthetics, how they dress up like the Sith Lord with the, you know, the Guy Fawkes mask. You know, it's just like they're just so impoverished of taste, you know, in a certain sense. And, you know, you describe them as Yudkowsky-pilled vegan transhumanist AI doomsday cultists. So how do you kind of like unpack, you know, because I think, you know, your sort of philosophical background is very strong. How do we get to the more sort of like cringe elements of contemporary philosophy and the philosophy of technology? Because this is kind of like stuff that I shy away from, but it's highly influential in how, you know, massive swaths of power, whether it be EACC or these, you know, effective altruists, how they think.
Yeah, totally. I mean, so yeah, the Ziz's blog is particularly good for kind of, I mean, she kind of lays out in kind of excruciating detail exactly how she kind of got to this kind of like cringe philosophy with, yeah, I totally agree. The aesthetics are truly awful. Ziz in particular, but I think most of the Zizians were known for wearing like Sith Lord black robes and Guy Fawkes masks and kind of just like the most obvious kind of, like, I think Ziz is even a, the name Ziz is from, I think it's the, there is actually in the kind of larger Star Wars canon, Darth Sidious, there's a sort of lady of the Sith Lords as well. There's like a Sith lady called, I think, Ziz. So yeah, I mean, the aesthetics are just really kind of basic kind of sci-fi, that kind of thing. But I mean, I think like, yeah, cause on her blog, Ziz sort of explains how, and it's probably a pretty typical journey for a lot of the kind of, well, a lot of people in general now, but certainly like a lot of theory bros for sure in general, but I don't know, San Francisco, Bay Area, California tech bro demographic. But yeah, Ziz basically talks about how she just started out like watching, you know, those kind of YouTube videos of like Richard Dawkins destroys trad Christian, or yeah, like Sam Harris destroys like, you know, Islamic cleric or whatever.
So
and
awful.
Then just through that just was like, yes, the power of reason, the power of rationality, and then sort of gravitated more towards the specific form of rationalism, contemporary rationalism, that's very popular in the California tech industry, effective altruism. And also kind of crucial to this is also, she's like a vegan as well, strong adherent to veganism. The kind of like key kind of daddy figure here is probably Peter Singer, whom I'm unfortunately quite familiar with philosophically, just because he's from Melbourne. Spent a lot of time at most of the universities that I teach at in Melbourne. Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't understand, if they don't come from Melbourne, that it's only really like a philosophy like effective altruism can, a philosophy that degenerate can only really come out of the kind of specific condition, historical conditions that is kind of the degeneracy of Melbourne. But that's another story. But yeah, I don't know. So yeah, so Ziz just talks about literally just getting, just watching these YouTube videos, just learning about Peter Singer, effective altruism, veganism. So moving from rationalism to a specifically effective altruism, and then even more specifically, because I think at this point she's sort of working in the kind of San Francisco kind of tech industry, getting into specifically Yudkowsky and Nick Bostrom's kind of spin on that, the kind of long-termist kind of AI safety kind of, yeah, vision. Yeah, because a lot of people would sort of see this as her kind of version of it, which does have variations, as kind of like some kind of perversion, or some kind of like mass sort of qualitative rupture with long-term AI safetyists. But in a lot of ways, it's just kind of a logical extrapolation. Like, it's
Right.
not really that crazily different as far as,
No,
I
not at
don't
all. It just seems like a more accelerated version of it, it kind of the way that somebody like Land could potentially try to gain agency over Deleuze and accelerate certain factions of
know.
his philosophy. They've basically done that with Yudkowsky, essentially, which is why you kind of characterize it as they've injected their brains with too many trolley problems. Like the thing with like they were afraid to kill the ants or something, but they did it anyway because they would be late to like saving the world. It's like completely bizarre, but at the same time, I think, this is just people's brains on the postmodern temporality and the speed in which these things manifest, and which is why I think, Berardi, Franco Bifo Berardi, the autonomous quote unquote Marxist theorist, he's kind of been taking this Byung-Chul Han-ish road that, actual revolution is withdrawal from the systems, and it's not that we are exploited, it's that we're exhausted. And so this is basically, and it's interesting because you talk about how they would do this thing where they would leave one eye open and one eye closed so they could like split the self in two, in this kind of Manichean dualist way, which I think is really strange. And one of them ended up committing suicide because of sleep deprivation. So it is truly a harbinger or an omen of the contemporary condition just taken to its absolute furthest extremities, pushed to these places.
Yeah, I think this is already kind of implicit to a certain extent in just, kind of AI safetyism, long-termism and stuff in general. But yeah, it's really kind of like this just, it makes it very explicit, this kind of Manichaean metaphysics where it's sort of like for her, there's, as you were saying, like for her, there's kind of these two kind of almost Manichaean realities where there's the normal normie social reality where, it's fine to kind of eat meat. It's just all the things that are conventional in society. So yeah, eating meat is totally fine. You're not really, maybe you're a bit anxious about AI, but you generally don't think it's going to sort of going to punish you from the future in these weird kind of basilisk chambers and that kind of thing.
Maybe explain Rocco's basilisk to people so people can kind of understand the history behind some of the Zizian's fears of this, super god AI. And what's his name? Jared with the dreadlock guy. You know who I'm talking about, though. Yeah, what he had some whole thing about that as well, about how God would be. But just to maybe give a primer on Rocco's basilisk and maybe Manichaeanism, which is a early Gnostic metaphysics system based in pre-Zoroastrian, pre or post, I actually forget.
Because I guess for Manichaeans, as far as I understand it, there's kind of these two kind of very distinct ontological kind of forces or realities as which are good and evil, basically. But I mean, that's simplifying it. So like Ziz kind of in just in that sense, Ziz has a very kind of kind of two world view where there's like normie reality, but then like if you tap into the kind of powers of reason, of kind of effective altruists, Yudkowskyan kind of rationality, then you're able to access this kind of other reality, this rational reality, where you realize that eating meat is evil, because it's hurting other living beings, and AI is almost certainly going to kill us. And it's kind of it's this sort of it's that kind of because when Ziz sort of hits upon this kind when she kind of so basically I guess yeah because for I guess for like Yudkowsky and that squad it's they're still kind of living in the same reality even though they have this kind of more purportedly more rational kind of perspective on things whereas for Ziz it's like you're outside this you through reason you get outside the simulation and you're in this actual kind of pure rational kind of realm. It's once she's sort of tapped into that, that she gets into these kinds of extreme, like the one you've mentioned a couple, like the basilisk and like the ants. And yeah, I mean, some of these are just like really interesting and kind of bizarre. Like, so yeah, she keeps getting in these kinds of insane kind of psychological conflicts between normie reality and then kind of like pure rational reality. Like she, the ants thing you were talking about is a good example where she talks about she's, because yeah, pure rational reality tells you that eating meat is wrong, hurting any kind of sentient living being is wrong. So she goes to have a shower, and in the shower, there's a couple of ants. And so she's like, well, I can't have a shower because I need to like very carefully remove these ants from the shower in line with pure rational reality. But then she's going to be, if she does that, she's going to be late for work, or if she doesn't have a shower, she's going to smell at work, and she's going to get, and that's not going to be good because at work, she's going to be able to make heaps of money and then donate that to kind of effective altruist causes to save the world from potentially, yeah, but from AI basilisks and other kind of existential risks. And so she comes, so there's like this kind of weird calculation she has to do. Okay, well, it's work. I guess I have to sacrifice the life of these couple of ants and have the shower so that I can ultimately minimize the potential for existential risks by working hard and donating my money. It's kind of like just weird shit like that. Like, right. But it's also just not, it's not even, yeah, like the, it's not even just, she's just come to this kind of really insane version of it.
It's kind of like it's kind of like this anti-Kantian cringe dialectics. You know, that's kind of how I see it, as like this embrace of like this unmoored ethics that people can't access, but she has specific access to, which I think is very sort of prevalent as an ideology on both, you know, the kind of far left that are particularly online or sort of rehashing these 20th century tropes about revolution and marginality. And you can see it also in the far right, in which the king is absolved of all sin. The monarch has absolute power and sovereignty. Therefore, they can't sin because there's no, I think on both of these extremes, there's no redemption, there's no possibility for redemption, and there's no universality of sin or wrongdoing. But there's also this kind of like adherence to a moral system that's essentially Gnostic or postmodern or whatever you, Manichaean, whatever you want to call it. I see this as a huge, huge problem amongst people today. And it's very, very frightening. It scares me quite a bit, honestly.
No, totally. I think you're, yeah. And I think you're right that in terms of, yeah, this kind of overlap with kind of online left and just online kind of, I don't know, radical groups. It's, yeah. I mean, cause all of this is being, I mean, this Zizian thing as well is all just being propagated online. It's definitely a part of this idea that, you know, you're kind of perspective is somehow this absolute kind of truth, and anything else that kind of even slightly contradicts that is just kind of pure illusion or evil is very much, I mean, it seems like that would be, this is kind of another symptom of the kind of filter, online filter bubble, kind of like
right,
getting trapped in weird echo chambers and your kind of own personalized algorithms and that kind of thing too, I think.
It's so interesting to me that people think that they can advance some sort of revolutionary change, or, you know, a withdrawal of revolution, like a sort of reaction or reactionary tendency through these algorithmic processes. I just think Franco, like Bifo and Byung Chul Han, I just think they're right. I mean, we can see, we have plenty of historical evidence of recent times to suggest that all of these things are a capture. You know, like they all sort of lock us in these sort of rhetorical based expressions, which are kind of like the de facto, it's the de facto industrial production of neoliberalism itself, you know, is the kind of ideological echo chamber, is online, you know. Boris Groys has talked about this a bit as well. I think this, you know, to me, like, this is like the thing that I think also scares me the most. And also in Berardi, he wrote that essay on Mangione, and he wrote a lot about like Samantha Rupnow and, you know, school shooters, and how there's this new advent of people who are just kind of in a war of all against all, you know, and how these ideologies don't necessarily, they don't tract, you know. For Mangione, it's like, he was a teal bro, you know, like he basically was like a center right rationalist kind of person, you know, similar to these things. And it's like, I don't see it. I don't see a material change here. Like, where is the change? Like, the problem with these like dialectical expressions is that they're, the, especially now, they're reinforcing these like impersonal powers, you know, be it the algorithm, be it sort of late end or whatever capitalism we have today. And it is truly kind of evil, you know, to even partake in it, in any of it, in a kind of overtly reinforcing way. And so to me, the only answer is subversion, you know, an exit. And I don't know, like, where do the Zizians and where do these monarchists and all these weird people, like, where do they fall into all of this, you know?
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, they're definitely a symptom of that. When Biffo, I think Biffo and Hahn both almost, it's almost, they've almost said it in this exact same kind of phrasing. In the absence of any kind of real potential revolution today, the choices of like resistance are suicide or terrorism, and or sometimes both. And yeah, I mean, I think this is all part of the same phenomenon, like the Mangione, the Zizians. Yeah, and it's kind of, it's weird how this idea that like Mangione is kind of like a centrist is kind of interesting, because, which, yeah, I would agree, because, you know, like a lot of this kind of Zizian stuff, it still hasn't really gone full. There's been like a lot of reportings, but it's still, like, I was kind of wondering whether just today, because people are so online, just even kind of older generations, that whether any of this would even be weird or not. But I think it probably, I think if you're like a true normie today, this is like, and you, someone told you that there were these Zizians and what they're about, you would still think it's pretty, pretty crazy.
Right.
I think. I'm
yeah,
not sure.
No, but I definitely think so. I think most people do think it's crazy. You know, like I think when most people seriously entertain these ideas as having some, as being representative of new forms of power. Because you actually said in your Zizian article, you said in the sort of absence or the kind of death of Marxism, the two advances are accelerationism and existential risk. And you have the accelerationists on one side, and then you have the X-risk people on the other, who are kind of, you know, they're kind of manifesting this power right now. And it's strange. And a lot of people say, well, Marxism is real and, you know, viva the revolution. It's like Marxism as an ideology is completely dead. It had calcified and solidified itself in the 20th century through the expressions of statecraft and, you know, the PRC in China, which is very powerful. But to think that we can reimpose Marxism from the outside in the West, that's a stupid idea. I mean, like, leftists have to get completely real here, and they're not. And Berardi, his critique of this contemporary, you know, leftist politics of, you know, volunteerism and action and posting, you know, pictures of horrendous events online, you know, kind of, to him, it's like, it's kind of this just, it's just a total sort of reinforcement of all of these issues, you know?
Yeah, and that just gets even more stark as Berardi goes along in his books. Like that, I read his most recent one, which I think came out late last year.
Yeah.
Called Quit Everything.
Right.
And that's very much like just desert, like kind of like what you're saying, like just exit, just desert everything. I mean, that's definitely his most pessimistic book, even though he was already kind of like so kind of ultra resigned. But and I totally agree. Yeah, because I used to be a kind of Marxist. So like for a while, I kind of just thought Marxism kind of was, like the driving motor of history, or at least the kind of explanation for how the motor of history works. But then even for a long time, sort of after kind of abandoning or like shedding my Marxism, it just seemed like, yeah, there is no kind of like theoretical apparatus or kind of ideology that is kind of the hegemonic kind of driving force anymore. So I kind of sympathize with Marxists that it's hard, if you're like a Marxist, it's hard to, or if you, even if you were, it's just hard to see how any, I guess, because you just don't treat ideologies as kind of having kind of primary power.
Right.
Over. So it's hard to, you just look at everything else as like, oh, this must just be a ideological, a secondary reflection of a superstructural kind of symptom of something
right.
more material and fundamental. But like, if you just look today, like, yeah, the people in power do have ideologies. They're not pure kind of, these ideologies might be expressions of kind of their kind of economic, yeah, their class position or their kind
right.
of,
yeah, yeah.
Or the various economic dynamics or material forces, but they still very clearly adhere to certain kind of ideologies, like the ones you said, like effective altruism and effective accelerationism. So it's not as if, yeah, it just feels weird because it just feels as if, like I was talking to Ravina.
Those might be window dressing too, though. There might be more depersonalized structural things that are also happening, and these are just kind of like the fluff or the window dressing or like the pretenses of these, you know, of these like sort of historical developments that are happening. And this is kind of a way to sort of post hoc rationalize them, you know, like not to cut you off. I'm sorry about that. That was just something that I've been thinking of a bit.
No, yeah, totally. Yeah, I totally would agree with that. Like, I don't think, effective altruism or effective accelerationism are kind of adequate or like at all really accurate descriptions of like real, of what's really going on. Totally agree with that. But yeah, it's just that they are kind of in the same way that Marx, yeah, it's just that they do seem to be kind of, yeah, ideologies that actually are, they are kind of the competing kind of, they are competing for kind of ideological dominance now.
Right.
Kind of post-Marxist world. Like, if you just sort of looked at anyone with kind of any economic and sometimes political power, they probably adhere to one of these ideologies.
Right.
Like, and like Elon Musk definitely does, yeah. Mark Andreessen, a bunch of people in the J.D. Vance, a bunch of people in the Trump administration.
Right.
Yeah, like even I think like the clearest kind of the most recent clearest example of that is at the there was like the Paris summit, I think in February, the AI Paris summit that J.D. Vance spoke at. And it was kind of his first international kind of speech and trip. So it was kind of like had a certain kind of anticipation and importance of like what he's going to set, what is he's going to be his tone for kind of international diplomacy. And the key quote from the speech was, it was basically like, he definitely had EAC writers, speech writers, because he was explicitly just chastising AI safety by name. Like, he just kept saying like the future is not going to be built right. by AI safety. It's going to be by whinging about safety. It's going to be built by actually building AI
right.
and accelerating AI. And it's like, okay, so they've infiltrated the White House then.
Of course. We have a Palantir occupied White House. I think that's, it is kind of incredible to see this happen, and it may have been a historical inevitability. Another thing that's interesting though too is, I think as, you know, sort of aesthetically depraved these two competing ideologies are, the one thing that they absolutely understand that, you know, 20th century ideologies, or at least these kind of reductive portrayals of, you know, something like Marxism or a kind of leftist materialist analysis doesn't get, is basically neuroplasticity, is how these things are affecting and shaping our subjectivities. And they have a great ability to sort of capitalize on this through either, you know, using these platforms that incentivize rage bait, incentivize extremism. And, you know, it's like, I don't understand why there is no, even from the Hegelian sense insofar of like, you know, the third path of the master-slave dialectic is also the one, it's the inner path of, you know, you hand the slave the whip that eventually whips itself, you know. Byung-Chul Han sort of talks a lot about this kind of like auto exploitation that's missing in a lot of readings of Hegel. And I do think that's a huge component, I think, of people's psychosis, is that they have absolutely no sort of understanding. It's like, you are generating profit for these platforms, you know, like, you're sort of enacting these forms of symbolic martyrdom and self-flagellation with content and this kind of endless pornography and doom scrolling and, you know, you could say moral posturing. It's just, you're just generating value for these platforms, you know? So your grief it's not real. It's material. And I think this is another point you brought up in Alfred Sohn-Rethel, in that capital is kind of interlinked with like cognitive behavior, you know, or critical thought itself. And I think there's no real way to kind of escape this. But there are things we can do, you know, and I think the truth is to slow down, is to actually withdraw. Like, that is the revolution. It's that simple. Like,
yeah, no, totally. I mean, it's almost kind of like the Zizekian kind of spin on, for they know not what they do, where it's like, yeah, we know what we're doing, but we're doing it anyway, because on the one hand, it does seem like everyone seems to be aware that, you know, Mark Zuckerberg didn't create like Facebook to connect us with our friends. You know, the Social Dilemma, that kind of Netflix documentary that
I haven't seen,
and a Facebook whistleblower made. It came out like in maybe 2018 or something. But it was, even when that came out, I was watching it being like, surely this is not surprising to anyone. But yet, and in a way, it's not if you, but then on the other hand, yeah, we are just doing this anyway, though. So it kind of is, as we're acting as if we don't know it. That we're still online, addictively kind of doom scrolling. But yeah, and it's not for, in a way, I mean, this is kind of the opposite of withdrawal. But in a way, I kind of see almost that kind of like, it's obsessively being online as a kind of revolutionary act in a weird way. Certainly not like a kind of the old Marxist kind of progressive revolution, but just and it specifically for that reason of that you were saying, that that capital is tied to kind of cognitive thought, which is
right.
Just because, yeah, okay, so on the one hand us being online is about kind of, yeah, generating data that's harvested by these tech companies for kind of capital accumulation. But also the way that capital accumulation works for these tech companies is through they use the data to improve their AIs, their algorithms.
Right. Totally.
So it's this kind of, so it's like, weirdly enough, just being online, just like dancing on TikTok or like posting, is, you are in a certain sense contributing to an intelligence explosion, to kind of ever more constantly increasing, improving AI.
But is it really improving it if the data set is just people like dancing on, you know, if that's the data input? Like, that's, I think that's kind of the issue that I have, is this actually like some sort of revolution, or is this just, you know, replacing, you know, human performative actions or protocols, like, so similarly to the way I see like Marxism, not as an ideology, I see it as a protocol that is being used by states that have actually existing power. Like, since when will this sort of default into something like that and no longer kind of be a revolution? Also, I wanted to ask you a question. So you mentioned like the vibe shift since the MAGA and EAC alliance's victory.
Mm.
How would this shift relate to the emergence of like a group like the Zizians or these strange kind of like cultic factions? Like how would those things like contribute to that? Like what got us to this place of like, this is just normal in the news now, you know, like.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's a really good question. I think there's, yeah, they're not just like kind of some aberrant, yeah, I don't know, glitch. They're kind of really, I think they're kind of like a metonym for kind of almost world historical vibe shift potentially in a weird way. Maybe that's a bit too strong, but yeah, I mean, just in the sense that, because they represent the AI safety ideology or the effective, in terms of that kind of debate we're talking about, this between competing ideologies to become the dominant ideology of effective accelerationism and effective altruism, they represent the effective altruist side, the kind of they're kind of the Leninists of effective altruism or something.
They're the real Marxists.
yeah. They're kind of like, in the way that Ted Kaczynski puts into practice Jackaloo or something like that. That's kind of what they're like. They're Ted Kaczynski and Yukowski is like Jackaloo. But I guess what kind of initially made me think this is that there's a kind of vibe shift going on here in part is there's just so many parallels with, you know, probably the most famous cult ever, the Manson family.
Right. I wanted to ask about that too. So what are some of these parallels between the two?
So there's certain kind of like clear ones, like the fact that there's both this kind of San Francisco Bay Area kind of sort of setting. There's these overlaps in the sense that there are connections in both groups to very prominent figures. So with like Charles Manson, you've got, you know, Dennis Wilson, the Beach Boys, Roman Polanski, Sharon Tate, and so on. With the Zizians, you've got the fact that the Zizians were associated with AI rational groups and institutes in California, like Yukowski's Machine Intelligence Research Institute and the Center for Applied Rationality. And these are all funded by prominent figures like Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and Sam Bankman-Fried and
right.
Vitalik Buterin. So there's kind of these, yeah, there's like these kind of, I mean, that's just one reason why I feel like the Zizians are destined, like the Manson family, to become culturally relevant is just because they're just tied to, yeah, powerful people. And then finally, there's sort of this overlap in terms of both of their ideologies being so kind of apocalyptic. Like, I mean, now we know, thanks to the Tom O'Neill book Chaos, that the kind of whole helter skelter kind of ideology was maybe it was real, but maybe they did believe that, but it's not. Maybe that's not why they...
I kind of feel like a lot of stuff in that book is fake, honestly.
The Tom O'Neill one?
Like, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't really... I've just skimmed through it, but...
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but no, another interesting point that you've made is that, you know, the Manson murders kind of did this whole thing to, you know, discredit the hippie movement, which sort of ushered in a new cultural vibe shift and an embrace of like, you know, Reagan era neoliberalism.
Yeah.
You could almost say that these are unwitting agents that are sort of aiding the side of the effective accelerationists who just want to build and accelerate artificial intelligence.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's really the key. 'Cause like all those other things I said, like the kind of San Francisco setting, the kind of connections to prominent figures, the weird apocalyptic ideology, in a way that's just all kind of like aesthetic or kind of not aesthetic, but like somewhat surface level kind of connection, kind of parallels between the Zizians and the Manson family. But yeah, the key one I think that's really, yeah, important is what you just said, that, yeah, I mean, I kind of do adhere to the kind of, yeah, I don't know, analysis of the Manson family as kind of what it did, or the more specifically the Tate LaBianca murders, like its cultural impact was to discredit the 60s counterculture to a large, not entirely, but to a large extent, or at least to kind of muddy the waters a bit, in the sense that, okay, now these hippies that were associated with like peace, love, innocence, are now associated with kind of substance abuse, drug addiction, madness, satanic murder rituals. I kind of see the Woodstock Festival as sort of like maybe the top signal for the counterculture, which happened just a week after the Manson murders. And then the Manson is kind of like the tops in, and now it's the counterculture is in decline. But yeah, I mean, I think because yeah, it's the fact that
and Altamont Speedway, the Rolling Stones concert with the shooting and
oh yeah,
the Hell's Angels stuff that got out of control. And I mean, there is a lot of evidence to suggest that Charles Manson was a potential, you know, operative in a sense, or a kind of. Or a patsy, you know, I think is a more accurate term. I don't want to get to these sort of speculative places with the Zizians, like, are they patsies? Is this sort of a controlled experiment by, you know, large sectors of, you know, by like Y Combinator or something like that? Like, I don't think that's that interesting, honestly, because it's too speculative. But I do think the philosophy that underpins it is extremely useful to crack down and oppose something like any kind of skepticism towards acceleration, you know, or state acceleration,
totally agree. You know. Yeah. Yeah. That's what I see as the key parallel. The fact that, yeah, I mean, I think it's like, it's no... By no coincidence, I don't mean necessarily like conspiratorial, but I just think it's kind of, I mean, just the fact that Ronald Reagan was the governor at the time and kind of led the charge against Manson and kind of the media charge, and it kind of, and Reagan is the one to kind of usher in the end of the 60s counterculture in favor of kind of neoliberal, rampant neoliberalism. Yeah, that to me is just clear the Manson family were are kind of the kind of emblem of that cultural vibe shift from 60s counterculture to neoliberalism. And yeah, I think the Zizians are so important is that I think they're the same. They're the emblem for the vibe shift that we're still undergoing, but that's certainly is indeed underway. Because yeah, the Zizians are kind of everything that. They just perfectly embody and cover in blood everything that both the accelerationists and kind of the aligned MAGA kind of forces detest the most. Like they're most of the Zizians are trans. They're all vegans. They're extremely pro AI safety, and they're a perfect encapsulation of everything that that MAGA and effective accelerationists oppose, and they provide the perfect means to discredit it because they themselves have covered veganism, covered trans politics, covered AI safety in blood, in like this like they've made it seem like this insane kind of horrific kind of thing, in the same way that Manson made the hippies counterculture seem like. And that's why I think like I'm not making any kind of strong conspiratorial claims here, but I do think that in the same way that Manson helped Reagan kind of discredit the 60s counterculture so perfectly, that there are these claims, and as you say, actually there are, as in the Tom O'Neill book, there do seems to be at least some plausible evidence that he may have actually been like a direct psyop or an unwitting psyop. Like CIA or CIA asset, in the same way the Zizians kind of so perfectly discredit AI safety and kind of lefty politics, that I think it can't help but in time I think just necessarily going to raise the suspicion that they are also a psyop. And I think that it's somewhat what kind of sort of gives some, what's going to, I'm not saying it's correct, but what's going to give some kind of, I don't know, credence to that suspicion is the fact that these AI safety institutes like Center for Applied Rationality and MIRI, Yukatsky's MIRI, where the Zizians are kind of emerging from and splitting from, they're precisely funded by the kind of mega EAC forces like Peter Thiel and Elon Musk. And so it's just kind of like, I mean, these groups were directly funded. It's just weird that the forces of kind of full dark mega accelerationism now, like Elon, were funding these AI safety institutes out of which the Zizians came. It's just a bizarre kind of turn of events. I mean, yeah, again, I'm not making any kind of, I wouldn't go full speed with this conspiracy, but just that there's definitely kind of some fertile ground for no doubt there will be endless conspiracies based on those connections.
And I think it's important to understand that, like, yeah, sure, there is a kind of conspiratorial side to this, but there's also something that's, you know, deeply theoretical that can also be kind of reinforced and instrumentalized. And I think this is kind of why some of the conspiracy stuff and you kind of need to unify these theories and understand how these, you know, rational logics work. Because there, as you kind of said, like, there is a revolutionary element insofar that it is, you know, it is shaping the subject, you know, it is, I think, you know, one of people say, you know, the main subject of history is the proletariat. Well, now it's capital, you know, like the capital is the thing that sort of reconfigures our subjectivity. It reconfigures our cognitive capacities. It completely sort of, like, if we don't take plasticity into account, this is why I love Catherine Malibu so much, is because she sort of talks about this idea of, you know, plasticity kind it, to her, it's like, this is almost everything, you know, this is the sort of domain in which life functions. And therefore, you know, ideas about marginality are not necessarily connected so much to these, you know, historical things of like your skin color or your this or your that. Like, there is a completely new dimension that's emerged. And this is kind of Pierre Bourdieu. He talked about this a little bit as well. And this is just why I think people are so crazy, is because they cannot grasp the fact that you self-exploit, you are exhausted, you are screaming, and you are seeking a voice because you're kind of unfulfilled, and you are flattening, you know, human complexities into symbolic avatars that in the same way an algorithm or a data set would. And so you are completely, you know, lockstep with the logic of capital and the auspices of leftism or traditionalism or any of these like stupid categories, you know? And I think it's ridiculous, you know, and it's, people are not saying like enough about what kind of bullshit this is. So.
No, totally. Yeah. Cause it's surprising that Marxists couldn't realize how kind of capital could kind of sort of stretch, how far it could stretch our neuroplasticity, because I mean, it's like, it was the communist vision that wanted the Soviet new man, like the kind of
total
kind of psychological and as well as economic material kind of transformation of the human. And it's like, well, if that's possible, then that, like, if you have this vision of a kind of post-capitalist future that we're so psychologically different to where we are now, I mean, in a way they were right in the sense that, yeah, we are vastly neuroplastic in that way, but it turns out we can also go so much further in the direction of kind of like what they thought was kind of the limits of the capitalist psyche was nowhere near the limits, it turned out.
100%.
I mean, and I guess that's kind of why, that's also why this whole, so in terms of the whole kind of conspiracy angle of all of this, I mean, in general, like, I find conspiracy theories kind of a bit kind of like anthropomorphic, in the sense of they're putting a human face, a conscious, rational human face to kind of impersonal forces and dynamics.
Right.
But the reason, and that's not to say that, you know, that there's obviously cases where kind of, you know, certain kind of, I don't know, secret government agencies or whatever are sort of pulling the strings. But the point is that it's not like though that agency is just sort of consciously doing it, you know, purely for their own self-interest. It's also that they're a part of Like even if the CIA or whatever is behind kind of Manson or Peter Thiel or whoever is behind kind of the Zizians, which I don't think is necessarily the case, but just even if that was the case, it's not as if it's just Peter Thiel in control. It's like Peter Thiel and the CIA are then also, they're also just doing this because they're stuck in certain kinds of dynamics of capital as well.
And of Schumpeter. It's just Schumpeterian creative destruction. It's like not, I think this is, you know, this is what Kondratiev was essentially purged from the Soviet Union for, is he wanted to show that, you know, these things of this kind of creative destruction is latent in capital, which it does have a telos, but then it reinforces itself stronger in the end. And I think this, you know, like you said, it's like, if you want to talk about this sort of, this concept of the new man or the new subject, it is doing that, you know, it is creating, it's just the one that nobody asked for, you know, like that's, I think, the issue. And whether you're on the side of guiding that align or aligning those things, or you're for accelerating them, I don't think, you know, I still believe in something like the human soul, you know, which exists, you know, and kind of like this monadology of this hierarchy of a perception that humans have. And I do think that it inevitably will eat away at that and turn us almost kind of like in this Kojevian last man sense into this kind of like aristocratic animal, you know, which was kind of his fear about the whole situation.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we're definitely being transformed into something.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? And also, I kind of wanted to sort of ask, like, how has the media coverage of NRX and the EAC in the White House and, you know, these kind of dark enlightenment forces, you know, gaining some sort of political power, or the Zizians, like, how has this kind of influenced, like, public perception? Has it softened it in a way? Has it hardened it? You know, like, that's the kind of thing that I'm interested in.
Yeah, I mean, there's been like a bunch in terms of the Zizians. Firstly, there was a kind of initial kind of, just general reports of like, oh, there's like this weird cult, but then kind of like longer articles like The Wired and others that are kind of longer pieces. But yeah, I'm just kind of surprised that, because I have this like angle where it's like, this is so perfect for the Trump administration. And yet, I haven't really seen even kind of the EAC bros like Beth Jesus or anything really talk about it that much. But I think it might take a while to filter out. Maybe they don't want to talk about it because they are kind of connected in the sense that of these institutes and stuff that they were funding. I think there's going to be a lot more to this story still, because I don't think this is like part of like a news cycle from a couple of months ago, because all of this is going to go to trial, and these Zizians are ready for like a really public trial. For the guy who, Maximilian Schneider, who murdered one of the witnesses, Curtis Lind, a reporter visited him in prison, and he gave this, he had like written out a kind of speech, which was then published. And it was like a letter. It was like a public open letter to Yukowski himself. And this kind of appeal that we did this to try and convince you to join the kind of Zizian cause. You need to see the errors of your way and how you've fallen back into normie reality, and you need to join us again in kind of pure rational reality. Apparently there's been lots of like weird kind of behind, like at the kind of court hearings and stuff so far, like, there's like another Zizian member who keeps like escaping, apparently, faking injuries and then suddenly escaping or attacking the guards and stuff. And Ziz at her court hearing was talking about how she doesn't care about anything. She just, the most important thing in the world is that she gets a vegan diet. That's like more important than anything. And So yeah, I think like they're gonna have, I think they're all gearing up for like a really public kind of spectacle.
Because we don't have many photos or images of what they actually look like. You know, there's like this really weird one where it's like Ziz's face is like kind of tilted to the side and she's like, you know, kind of being like examined in a strange way. Like that's a really kind of striking image. And also one thing that's interesting is Ziz comes from Alaska, and I don't know if you know anybody. I have a lot of family, half my family's from Alaska.
All right.
Alaska, it produces quacks. Like it just does naturally. So I believe Ziz is from, I think, the Anchorage area. That was kind of an interesting little tidbit because the people up there, you know, to deal with that kind of extreme weather, like they have their quirks, definitely.
That's interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe this is like a my kind of like ignorant like Australian perspective, but the only kind of yeah, I only know one person from his family's from Alaska, and they were just telling me this story of I don't know if this is actually what it's like all the time or something, but they were that they were like they got a call from their neighbor or something saying, "Hey, I accidentally locked myself out of the house, and I'm so you need to get here in 10 minutes or I'm gonna freeze to death," which I didn't know was kind of like
Oh yeah.
the threat
Yeah,
of
definitely.
like you can't just sort of wander home drunk or something,
No,
but.
no. People die from stuff like that all the time there.
That's pretty wild. Yeah, and like I mean, yeah, because there's all this other all this other stuff that I'm still kind of like investigating of Ziz's father was is also like an AI researcher, weirdly enough. I mean, unsurprisingly. And yeah, there's so many, yeah, just to throw another kind of conspiratorial kind of thing out there is that yeah, like this guy, Maximilian Schneider, who sort of had the open letter to Yukowski from prison and one of the Border Patrol agent shooters, they actually went to the same high school, which is I can't remember the name of the high school, but it's considered one of the best, most prestigious high schools in the US, which and Bill Gates went there, for example. And basically like every kind of entrepreneur, CEO, like major CEO you've heard, like so many of them just went to this school. So yeah, I mean there's already that kind of there's that whole angle as well, potentially. Yeah, because in a way, these are kind of like elite. These are like the children of elites as well.
It's
Yeah.
a really strange thing. Ask you a little bit about this like UFO stuff and